The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Yes, coming to you cordless, everybody. It's 11 p.m. on the East Coast of the United States, 8 p.m. on the West Coast, 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Sydney, Australia, and here where I'm sitting in Northeast Minneapolis, it's 10 p.m. Central Time. I'm Jim Peters. Welcome to another edition of Jim Peters at Night, episode number 85. Yet we're through it, and someday I'll be dead. So will you. Okay, it's Thursday, February 15th, 2024. I just want to say hello to everybody watching. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. Michael Harrison was on here on Tuesday. It was UN World Radio Day, and he was the head of that for the UN. Yeah, I know. We actually got somebody from the UN on this show. It's unbelievable. Anyway, I want to thank you. We had quite a few people in the last 48 hours have checked that episode out, and on Rumble we've had several hundred people subscribe to us, and I really appreciate it. Thank you. So we are live on 7 video platforms, including Rumble, YouTube, Twitch, Trovo, 3 others, Odyssey. I can't remember. I've always said this. I only really pay attention to Rumble, and I pay attention to YouTube because I assume eventually they will cancel us because we've done 85 shows. We've already been flagged for misinformation 4 times. So, you know, just right out of the gates. Just bang, what are you talking about? The climate change stuff is real. No, it's not. It isn't. So anyway, yeah, thanks to the people on Rumble. We're on Blog Talk Radio now, too. If you go to blogtalkradio.com, they have a live listing there, and we usually show up in the live section about a few hours before we go on the air. We're under current events, if I'm right, if you want to look that up. That's a subsection of news. And also, because of that, too, you can call in. Blog Talk Radio has provided us with a call-in phone number. And that number, it's on the bottom of your screen right here, 563-999-3435. And if you call up, and I haven't mentioned this before, if you call up, a really sexy British lady will talk to you. I don't know who they got to do these announcements for Blog Talk Radio, but she's pretty cool. And so that's pretty it. So, yeah, you got that going on. We got that going on. So you can also call with your camera right here. Okay, you go to jimandnight.com/call. So the deal is we're supposedly the first talk show in America to take video phone calls, supposedly. Talkers Magazine said that. We'll see. You know, we don't know, but I've never seen anybody else do it. I looked around to see if anybody else was doing it, and Michael Harrison told me, he said, no one's doing it that we know of. So they ran a nice article. That was in July, 2 weeks before we started. So, and then finally, you can text me right here, that number right there, 408-458-5088. I'm now taking the text live on the air. I got a monitor here off to my side that I have phone calls and text messages on, and then straight ahead here, I got the video phone calls. So, yeah, you can call in, and do you want to call in tonight? Because we have a live guest, Nathan Wooster from the Epoch Times is here. He's been on the show. If you go back to the radio shows and podcasts I did years ago on Conk News, he's been on several times. He was on this show in particular last, I think it was November, I think. Great guy, fantastic reporter, totally adept on what's going on. He covers politics and energy for the Epoch Times. He's been on the campaign trail. He's not there tonight. We're going to be talking to him from Chicago, if I'm right. But he's been in South Carolina. He covered the Democratic primary, which nobody paid any attention to, which Biden won with 96% of the vote. And he's also going back to cover, he's been covering the Republican primary there too. Right now, the polls seem to indicate that Trump is going to completely blow Nikki Haley out of the water. and that'll be interesting because it's their home state, and she was the governor there, and she actually was a pretty good governor, apparently. She did a good job, and Trump's going to kick her ass is what it looks like. But we'll talk to Nathan about that, and we'll talk about a whole bunch of other stuff, too. So he's tonight. We don't do Fridays here. We're lazy. This is my retirement job, and I don't want to work 5 days a week. I don't. So we don't do Fridays. Next Monday, Larry Newman will be here, our friend Larry Newman. He's the bails bondsman from Joplin, Missouri. And I got to make sure, and when we talk to him, I ask him about this. If I'm right, he's the head of the Missouri Bail Bondsman Association, or the president, or the past president, or something like that. Now, Larry is also, I love these people that do two different things. You know, we got Jazz Shaw, does the politics and the UFOs from Hot Air, and Nathan does energy, and he knows a lot about energy, too. I don't have any questions about that per se this time, but let's see if he has something to talk about. And Larry is a law enforcement officer, and also he's a certified, honest-to-God, Bigfoot investigator for the Bigfoot Field Research Organization. And the interesting thing about Larry is he started working for the BFRO as a skeptic. He didn't really believe in Bigfoot, but he said, I'll do this. You know, it's his wheelhouse. He knows his investigation. And he said he was cured of that skepticism when one night in the middle of the forest, he watched a family of Bigfoot through an infrared camera for an hour. So, pitch dark, he said, couldn't see anything, but with the infrared camera, it was all very obviously visible. And so he's been a believer ever since. We have a lot of people talking about Bigfoot on the show. I'm starting to become a believer. I was slightly skeptical when we started. Now, the question is, and we had, so Stan Gordon was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and then last week we had on, I'm not going to forget, am I? Hold on just a second. I got to check. Who was it? We had on, Albert Rosales, right, who's written 14 books on the concept of humanoid creatures. These aren't necessarily Bigfoot, and they aren't necessarily extraterrestrials or aliens or gray aliens or any of that sort of stuff. It's basically anything that walks on two legs and seems intelligent. He includes poltergeists, ghosts, everything, and just really, really weird shit. So he's written 14 books on this. He was on last week. If you go to Rumble and YouTube on our channels there, all this stuff is archived, so you can watch it. So his books are about a bunch of, he just collects stories that people have called in. Now they're calling them into him directly, but usually to MUFON or the BFRO or various organizations about some strange, crazy shit that happens to them. And it's crazy. I read his last book, 14 books in the series. His last book is from 2010 to 2015, about 250 cases. It's nuts. You can go to Amazon and order it. I ordered the Kindle version. It wasn't very expensive. I think it was like $6 or $10 or something. And he said this during the interview. If even 10% of this stuff's actually true, if people are making up or lying about the other 90%, if 10% of this is true, it's still crazy as hell. So the reason I brought that up is because I don't think Larry Newman, our friend coming on Monday, I don't think he subscribes to this. But Stan Gordon was talking about this, and Albert Rosales too, that when it comes to Bigfoot, there seems to be more going on than meets the eye. And I have a friend of mine who watches this show regularly, and he says, Jim, they can change planes. Yeah, right. Yeah, sure. But the thing is, there's a lot of people who have seen Bigfoot, who have watched Bigfoot disappear right before their very eyes. That has been reported many, many times. And I like Gordon's take most of all, because he said, I guess him and Rosales said the same thing. There's something really weird going on here, and neither one of them can figure out what it is, and I can't either. I listen to a lot of these stories, partly from doing this show and partly just because I'm a curious SOB. But anyway, so Larry's on Monday. Tuesday, we have Davis Hunt. He's the publisher and editor of The Pamphleteer, which is a news site out of Nashville, and it deals mostly – not entirely, but mostly with local Nashville news. And we're going to talk to them about the whole local news phenomenon, because I find it really fascinating that local news seems to be the thing that's really missing in our society, and yet nobody's really interested in it. And I got to admit, I'm not either. I mean, we don't talk about we do a little bit. I mean, our show's out of Minneapolis. I'm not trying to fool anybody here. We talk about it all the time, and which reminds me, I'll mention the weather in a second. And on Wednesday, the Dynamic Duo is back. We have them once a month. That's Jennifer Oliver O'Connell. She's a writer for Red State magazine or website, one of the Town Hall Salem properties, and also her own Substack, asthegirlturns.com, and Jeff Meyer, the CEO and publisher of Conk News, who was just on last night. Yeah. Matter of fact, we're going to reference him in a couple minutes. So, yeah, they're coming on a Wednesday. They love being together. It's a love fest, and you'll like that. And Jennifer is very, really interesting. Jeff is Jeff. No, I'm just kidding. Jeff's really – my line on Jeff is that he always has something interesting to say. You may not agree, and you may even think he's nuts, but he has something interesting to say, and that's for damn sure. So – the complaint we had, he joked about it last night, is that people say he's depressing. He said he's trying to turn that into anger now. He said, no, I'm not depressing. I'm angry. Yeah, sure. And also, while we're at it here, Conk News is exclusive sponsor of the, oh, Jesus Christ, of this website. There we go. We got a little bug here, and that is if the page flips over while I have it queued up, it disappears like you care. That's the front page of Conk News right now in real time, this very second. Conk News is a news aggregator. They don't actually write, well, they do. They write a few things, but generally they collect news from other sources, 75 different sources that they collect news from every 3 hours. And the computers and the servers lay it out on this page. And you'll notice here, if you can see this and you can't see my cursor, and I know I keep reading, don't point to them. So the deal is the headlines are from the articles. They aren't rewritten. The photos are from the articles. And if you click a headline or a photo, you go directly to the article. There's no interstitial page or any of that sort of stuff. So essentially it's a newspaper that combines a bunch of articles from a bunch of other sources. That's what it is. And it's fantastic. If you're a news junkie, you can't do better than this. And like I said, this updates 8 times a day. So you can go there at 10 o'clock and read the news, and you can go back to 2 or 3 o'clock and it's all completely different. Well, not all, but mostly. If you go back down to the bottom of the page, that's where the older stuff is. So, and sometimes that's everything, you know, they add to the top and everything rolls down. So at any rate, yeah, check that out at conk.com. That's con. You're going to want to check that out. Because you love me. That's why. All right, so Nathan's coming on here in a few minutes. So I want to talk with, oh, first of all, I want to mention the weather. We got our first reasonable snowfall last night here in Minneapolis for the first time all winter. And this has been the winter that hasn't been, the winter that wasn't. Because so it was February 14th last night, the 15th today. And we've gone 2.5 months with virtually no snow whatsoever. The entire winter so far before last night, it only snowed 7 inches, the entire thing. There's no snow on the ground here at all. Now, overnight, we got more than we were expecting. They were predicting 2 or 3. We got about 6. Not that big a deal, you know. And not only this, it's been so warm here, it's probably going to be gone by Monday. It'll probably be melted. So, and yeah, and you're gonna call me up and say, yeah, Jim, that's global warming. That's climate change. No, it isn't. That's weather. It's just weather. That's all it is. Global warming. Now, here's the deal. Global warming is real. I don't know any scientist that disputes that. The world is warming up. That's absolutely sure. But are humans causing it? No. Now, if you want some proof of that, Patrick Moody, the climatologist, esteemed climatologist, was on our a show, I think it was October. It's the highest rated, highest watched program we've ever done. He will tell you in no uncertain scientific terms why human climate change is bullshit. He keeps saying, well, follow the science. The science has settled. Well, first of all, the science is not settled. settled. And secondly, we filed the science and turns out you're wrong. That's all there is to it. And we'll probably get, I'll probably get flagged again on YouTube for talking about climate change. I probably will. I do not care. Like I said, this is my retirement job. Ask me if I give a shit. So also, the night before last, I'm watching my normal modus operandi here. So we do this, it's 10 p.m. Central Time in Minneapolis. So I get done around 11:30. Our shows are about roughly in 90 minutes. And so I will usually grab a soda because I'm just and sit down and watch television. I usually watch Gutfeld. I tape the Gutfeld show and then watch it after we're done here. It kind of makes me laugh. Ha 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 ha. So two nights ago, I sit down, I turn on the Hulu Live, and I'm sorry about that. Yeah, it's a Disney property. I'm dropping it. And they're pushing me Jon Stewart's First Daily Show. And I thought, okay, you know something? I'm going to watch this. Now, I've never been a huge Stewart fan. He was on, you know, TV years ago. You know, he was on four nights a week. I think he did it for 14 years, I think it was. And everyone forgets this. He didn't start it. Craig Kilborn was the original host of the Daily Show. And then he went over and did the Late Late Show on CBS. And he's kind of been lost to history. And the amazing thing is he grew up about 25 miles away from me, even though I think I'm still older than he is. But so I didn't know the guy personally, but I know that our schools played basketball against each other. He was a big basketball player. And he's kind of been lost to the wind. It's kind of really weird. It's like if you're not on television, it's like you don't exist or something. But at any rate, he was the original host of The Daily Show, and Jon Stewart took it over from him. And I always thought Stewart did a pretty good job. He got the whole left wing of the Democratic Party's undies in a bundle. They basically like would cream their pants because he was on TV. But the amazing thing is, and this is kind of always been lost in the story, his ratings weren't that great. There weren't a huge number of people watching that. I mean, it was okay. He was drawing about 1 million people a night, but Gutfeld draws like 2 million, you know, and Hannity and Tucker Carlson before he left, they were drawing 3 million. It was okay. He was doing all right. But I watched the first episode here. He's only going to be doing Mondays now, at least through the election. I think they're probably going to talk him into coming back permanently. That's what I think, but we'll see. And I have to say, it was fucking masterful. I mean, it was, you know, maybe that's pent up frustration. I don't know what the hell that was, but I mean, it was 14 minutes of comedy genius. It was, you know, and to his credit too, he's not just putting down Republicans, you know. I mean, he's making fun of Biden's age, and all the people on Fox News are saying, how come, you know, that's comedy gold and Saturday Night Live doesn't do it. Well, he was doing it. He was mercilessly making fun of Biden and Trump too. But, you know, Trump is like inherently funny. It's easy to make fun of Trump. There's this guy named Tyler Fisher, who comes on, now he's coming on Gutfeld regularly. He does a faultless impression of Trump, and he's also very good at writing his material, and it's just hilarious. I mean, I'm waiting for somebody to do something with this guy. I mean, my God, he's just fantastic. Now, Stewart's not an impersonator, but still, he's talking about these guys, you know, and the basic trust, we've got two essentially oxygenarians running for president, and that's nuts. And, you know, he's got a point. It is. It's crazy. Anyway, I was really impressed. So then I'm getting on I'm reading the Radio Trade publications yesterday, and somebody's saying, well, how come no one's ever tried to give Stewart a radio show? And, okay, so here's my take on that. Because this is something that really bothers me about executives in the quote-unquote entertainment business, if you want to put talk radio in that. They don't seem to understand that there's some of these talents that seem like they go together actually don't. Case in point, Stewart posting The Daily Show, I mean, that was the perfect fit for him, or actually he tuned the show to his personality. But it's a comedy show, and he's a comedian, and he writes masterful material. It's, I mean, he's great at it. I mean, he was like, led this week anyway. And I, you know, like I said, going back, I was never a huge fan, but I certainly didn't think he did a bad job at all. But you know, staring in a camera and telling jokes in front of an audience is completely different than hosting a talk show, and especially a talk show without an audience. I mean, which is essentially what I do here. And so, you know, my question is, okay, yeah, all right, he was fantastic at that show. Could he talk 70 minutes off the top of his head without a script? I doubt it. I don't think so. Now, could I do his job? Not very well. I mean, I you know, I'd probably do okay. You know, I'd be all right. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd hit a 6, I figure. You know, and I figure if he had to do what I'm doing this very second, I think about the same. I think he'd a 6. Now, and you may not think that. Here's a really good example of this. Stephen Colbert, when Letterman announced he was going to quit the Late Show on CBS, everyone said, well, you got to get Colbert, you got to get Colbert, you got to get Colbert. And I'm thinking, well, no, wait a second. This guy has never, ever appeared on television, not even for a moment, as himself. He's always been in character. He's always played another person. You know, even though it was fictitious, the Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report was a fictitious personality. Name just happened to have the same name. You know, but even he bitched about it after a while. He didn't like doing it. So you're talking about, you know, so you got a guy here who's never been himself ever, and one of the primary you need to do this job is basically you have to be able to be yourself on camera. And you maybe forgot this, but when he started the Late Show, he wasn't doing very well. They almost fired him. It was when Chris Licht came over and took over producer. He said, what are you good at? He said, well, I'm good at talking about liberal politics. He said, well, let's just do that. And that's what happened. And so, and he also has never done fantastic. He does a great best. His ratings are the best of all the people that do that, but they still aren't fantastic. They're not great, but he almost got fired for bad performance. And I'm not talking about qualitatively, I'm talking about the numbers, the ratings. But that's one of the things I'm talking about. No one ever stopped to think about the fact that he's never been on television as himself, and he had to learn how to do it. I got to be perfectly blunt. I don't think he's very good at it. I don't. He's still kind of like playing that Steve Colbert character, not completely, but anyway, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. So I have a whole bunch of other stuff over here I was going to go through, but Nathan is waiting in the wings, and so I'm going to play the 12-second bumper, and we're going to talk to him. How's that sound? Hey, watch this. Hey, Nathan, how you doing?
Great. How's the night treating you, Jim?
I'm a little bit asleep, but that's fine. I set my alarm on my phone here so that I make absolutely certain I wake up like 15 minutes ahead of time. But yeah, that's me. It's 4 nights a week. You know, what do you say? I can't complain. I'm doing it myself. So, you know.
Well, I'm a bit of a night owl myself. So certainly I'm probably one of your better guests for this time slot.
I appreciate it too. Yeah, especially the people on the East Coast do not want to come on at 11:30, so I don't like blame them. So we do a lot of pre-taping. So I want to thank you for doing it live. Now, because we're doing it live, Nathan, I just want to remind everybody: I'm not going to take your on-camera webcam calls, but if you want to call in audio, that's 563-999-3435, or if you want to text us. If you have a question for Nathan at 408-458-5088, please do so. And so, yeah, Nathan's live. You're live. You're there. I can see you. Yeah. Hey, so you're in Chicago, right?
I am, but I'm going to be heading to South Carolina in a few days in the run-up to the Republican primary on the 24th.
Were you actually there for the Democratic primary? Did you go there? Or I saw you.
I was there for that primary. I was there for the New Hampshire primary. And New Hampshire primaries, I should say, because the Democrats had their write-in primary. Wasn't there on the ground for the Nevada caucus or the Nevada primary, where Haley lost to none of the above or some other option on the ballot, which is entirely a strange story in and of itself, that she ran in the primary rather than the party-run caucus. And I was there in Iowa during that caucus as well.
So, go back to the Nevada thing. Do you think that they just, like, fucked that up?
You know, I haven't I haven't talked to anybody on the campaign yet who has been willing to speak to me. Frankly, if I were to speculate, best case scenario for them is that they were making a deliberate choice to ingratiate themselves with something other than the Republican Party, which, given the donors that she has cultivated, a lot of Democrats, maybe that was part of a grand strategy to draw in independents, draw in this money basically in line with her agenda, as opposed to in line with what Republicans generally want and what they would vote for. But yeah, I think it's more likely that somebody fucked up, to be honest.
That would
not surprise me.
Also, can you explain this to me too? So if, all right, it was like 70-30 to none of the above, right? Roughly?
Roughly, I'd have to look at the numbers, but yeah, it was a very high percentage that
okay.
got that.
That means that a whole bunch of people went to the polls expecting to vote for nobody. Am I right about that?
Well, expecting to vote for nobody send a signal that you can hear from sea to shining sea if you talk to Republicans, talk to voters about who they have wanted now for many, many months. One that, you know, if you actually now talk to the party elite, they seem to be sending the same signal. You know, there's a very small war chest that Republicans have. They've actually done a very poor job over the past few years with things like getting out the vote, early voting, actually, you know, raising money to be able to win elections. The Republican presidential candidate, in addition to that, Congress, the Senate. So the longer that this is dragged out, from their perspective, the worse it is. There's a smaller pot of money. The current leadership of the RNC doesn't seem to be very good at raising money. They're pretty good at, you know, buying limousines for themselves and such. But, the things that you'd expect a party leadership to do, which the Democrats have executed very well over the past few years, the Republicans have just fumbled in ways that seem like cell phones.
And so is that just incompetence? I mean, I don't understand this. I mean, the Republicans have historically been the party of big money and big business. So where the hell's the big money? I don't understand. Why are they failing at this? Is it just Ronna McDaniel who doesn't know what she's doing? Or what's going on?
You know, I think that's part of it. I think there's also this identity crisis within the party that is only now being resolved. I think partly as a result of the turnovers since 2015, 2016, you have now a generation of politicians, strategists, informed voters who came up under the Trump Republican Party. All the people who were very, very uncomfortable with Trump becoming the nominee in the first place, and then in many cases became never Trump Republicans or Democrats, or just, you know, are it's been a number of years since Trump was elected, so they're less relevant in the party. Their influence is beginning to ease, but I think there's this gap in terms of what the legacy party structure wanted and what the voters have generally wanted that is only just now coming back into place. And it seems as though, you know, Ronna Romney McDaniel initially was kind of as a selection, essentially, you know, the nominee gives the nod. That's how traditionally it goes. And so by bringing in somebody from a family like that, somebody from the more establishment wing of the party, it was a way for Trump to smooth things over, perhaps. That's one way of reading it. But, in terms of actual effectiveness, you would think that, you know, the establishment wing would be able to point, as, you know, McConnell often would like to do when he talks about electability of candidates, that sort of thing, that they could point to victories based upon these kind of, like, establishmentarian bona fides. But when they have candidates who they could try to make that case for, people like Youngkin, these are people who are, by the standards, they would not be Mitt Romney-era 2012 Republicans, and to the extent that they are, they're still aligning themselves with Trump. They're still very much Republicans of the new party. So to make this somewhat lengthy point succinct, I think that we're at this point now where there's a maturing new party structure that is really beginning to take the fore. But right now, the incompetence of the existing party structure has to be seen for there to be real changes and hopefully money spent more intelligently by them, assuming that you want to actually see Republicans win.
Nathan, you've been watching this for a long time, like years. Can you explain? All right, this is the part I don't get. So yeah, I understand what you're talking about the fact that the old guard doesn't, you know, kind of, I don't understand why they're so out of touch with the electorate. That's the part I don't get. Is it because I'm going to the supermarket? It seems plainly obvious to me that, you know, that the especially the Republican Party, wants a new direction. And these old people, they do not seem, can't seem to wrap their mind around it. Is it just that they're old, or what the hell's going on?
I think it's a variety of factors. You know, you look at one thing that a lot of intelligent people I listen to will say is that the modern Republican Party was kind of forged under Reagan in response to the Cold War. It was highly successful in terms of both addressing Cold War defense objectives and then advancing some of the culturally conservative agenda items. And you've actually been able to see this play out more fully in things like Roe versus Wade being overturned, a very different debate about everything from school choice, where I think you could argue the conservatives have made some very significant gains in recent years, to just the whole notion of originalism as a legitimate reading of the Constitution. Not that long ago, you had a much more activist Supreme Court. These days, there's this entire legitimate intellectual foundation for originalism. So, you know, that being said, the Republican Party in some ways, though, is still married to the side of that, I think, a set of imperatives that really people associate with George W. Bush when it comes to, you know, the U.S.'s defense posture, that a lot of people look at that, and this includes a lot of independents, even some traditional Democrats, and they say, hey, wait a minute, you know, I kind of like what I'm hearing about, you know, avoiding another Afghanistan, another Iraq. Why are these voices, these, you know, very moderate centrist voices, these great bipartisan figures, talking about kind of dragging us into more wars, which inevitably we're spending, talking about, you know, issues that for at least I think millennials often seem like obviously misguided based on what we've seen in the past few decades of American history, and at odds in many cases, directly at odds with the interests of American, you know, the American citizens who might wonder about, you know, many aspects of how the GOP chooses to operate. For example, everything from the selection of candidates in many cases as the party seems to want it to happen, to the issues that they focus on. You have many clear winning issues, things like immigration, mass immigration, in particular illegal immigration, but just generally mass immigration, including cases where the system is rejiggered such that people who would have previously been illegal immigrants are made legal immigrants, which is why, by the way, you know, just talking about illegal immigration can lead you into some logic traps. But immigration, these basic like fork and knife like issues when it comes to spending. But the Republican, I should say, aside from spending, things like inflation and just cost of living, things like actually creating the economic conditions for people to have like decent full-time jobs, as opposed to what we have now, where a recent analysis from the Center for Immigration Studies I looked at showed that the job growth since 2019 has been almost entirely among non-Native Americans.
Yeah, I saw that.
Immigrants.
Yeah.
Which is, you would think that our political class, instead of using that as an opportunity to either say, oh, you millennials are so lazy, that's why you're not getting the jobs, or on the other hand, to just say that any talk of this being strange or illegitimate is, you know, a sign of bigotry, that they might look at that and think, wait a minute, why are we not looking after the, you know, well-being of the people who are our country? But the citizens of the United States on both sides of the aisle, for somewhat different reasons, always seem to come last. And the Republicans, I think, with Trump have had an historic opportunity to appeal to Americans as Americans. And they're still fumbling the ball in many cases. They're getting closer in some, certainly as compared to 2015. But there is this tendency to really squander opportunities.
Having watched this for like 7-8 years now, there's a theory, and I think there might be some credence to it, although I haven't given this a lot of thought myself, about the fact that if Trump were to win now in the fall, his next term, having skipped 4 years, will actually be more consequential than if he had done 8 years nonstop. Do you think that's true?
I think on some issues, for example, one that, you know, the bipartisan Washington is much more comfortable now with his stance on China than they were before, for reasons that people could have questions about. For example, if you want us to have a, you know, better relations with China, fairer relations that don't amount to accommodating the you know, regime's human rights abuse and that sort of stuff, but also you don't want to necessarily go to war with China over Taiwan. If you have that position, then the you know, emerging Washington consensus can seem a little disturbing because, you know, it can seem like some of the same pieces that were moved into place ahead of Afghanistan and Iraq are being moved into place. But in a weird way, Biden is actually executing more of a hawkish strategy than Trump was able to. Of course, no credit will be given to Trump for that. And to the extent that it's hawkish in the sense that there's not this attempt to like really execute reciprocal tariffs and that kind of thing in a way that manages to advance peace. It seems more like we're advancing towards like yet another conflict out of many theaters of conflict where the United States is now committing men and materiel. But so that's one issue. I would say that on some others, Americans, in a way, I think the past year, 2 years, 3 years of what we've seen at the border and then what a lot of Americans are just seeing on their streets, like the sheer number of people that have come in, the sheer inability to cope. Suddenly you have these sanctuary cities are talking about not wanting to take in all these people. You do have people, I think, more open just at the grassroots level, people who wouldn't have previously been open to the proposals, you know, mass deportation, that sort of thing. You have that popular buy-in that I think could create the conditions for something lasting. But again, you know, if you just have something where, as before, Trump signs a bunch of executive orders or directs the Homeland Security Department, and then Biden just immediately reverses that, you know, the next Biden does that,
yeah,
it might not be lasting. But at the end of the day, if the Biden administration's immigration policy has decreasing popular legitimacy, if people are just getting fucking fed up with it across the aisle, and you know, I don't know if you were following this, but Stephen A. Smith, who is no conservative, he had a fairly lengthy televised rant on this issue.
Right.
I live in Chicago, you know, in the black community, when I talk to people or just listen, you know, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with that. That's just one example where the sense of popular discontent is palpable, and Republicans could easily build a more lasting coalition on that, as opposed to some of the more laughable attempts at pandering that they sometimes do.
Yeah. So you brought up Stephen A. Smith, and I was going to ask you about this. So there seems to be a shift, and you're alluding to this, among a lot of independents and even liberals about the fact enough of this crap. And they seem to be kind of coming over the dark side. I mean, I'm reading about this constantly. So when you're like out and about, oot and a boot, as the Canadians say, is this exaggerated? I mean, is this a real or is it underplayed? How do you feel? What is your take on this?
So I think that there's both a real shift, and I think there's also a residual aversion to talking about it. For the same reasons that you got a lot of shy Trump supporters in 2016, mm-hmm. You know, this total media environment that we live in can make people really shy about saying things that are very common sense and obvious to most of us, but they're just afraid of being castigated. And this applies, you know, just as much to black Americans concerned about their neighborhood's racial composition changing as to anybody else. And I was actually at Vivek Ramaswamy rally in South Shore in Chicago a few months back, based upon dissatisfaction in the community with a migrant shelter that was going to be moved into a shuttered high school. And so there, you know, at the same time that you had people voicing concerns about the migrant crisis, there were the kind of expected talking points about things like reparations and just, you know, social spending that I don't think those are going to be like conservative talking points anytime soon. On the other hand, you know, I was at South Carolina State University ahead of the vice president's speech there. I was in the student union with my photographer just talking to people. And these were not students who, you know, I didn't think that anybody would provide a particular, certainly like not necessarily a conservative point of view. I was just asking them, hey, what do you think about the vice president, expecting, and this was the case a lot of the time, people to just say, you know, enthusiastic things about having such an important political figure on campus. But I did speak with a few people, including one young man who just explicitly told me he was going to be supporting Trump. The big issue for him was war. The big issue was the perception that we are at the point of World War III, or if not World War III, then something that certainly feels much closer to destabilizing global conflict. There's possibly the selfish aspect of worry about a draft. I say selfish. I don't think there's actually necessarily that.
Well, I have to stop you. You look completely ageless to me. You could be anywhere from 28 to 55. How old are you?
33.
Okay, that's good. The reason I'm asking about that is because I can't imagine that on a campus that anybody would ever perceive you as being biased. You're really good at coming off as kind of like neutral, you know? I mean, you're talking to the kids. I assume they're talking to you back, right? Yeah?
Yeah, you know, you just talk to people, try to understand where they're coming from. And in this case, you know, I'd want to have a lot more conversations. I'll be back in South Carolina. I'll be talking to more voters on the ground, although it can be hard to find just completely random samples of people or just, you know, you don't necessarily want to always strike up a conversation with a random person without, you know, some sort of context.
Yeah,
report.
Right.
But all the same, I mean, my total sense is that, yes, I think there's more dissatisfaction over immigration, over war, over a variety of issues, cost of living, where someone like Trump in particular, I think, could have an advantage. And part of that is, I think, people do, even if they're not allowed to, people do respond to the personal charisma, factors like that, that just nobody else in American politics can match Trump in terms of the personal charisma. Even people who hate him, he generates that response because there is this magnetism to him. There's something that people can respond to as opposed to just completely drab politician who, you know, you might not like his policies, but you just don't have anything you can like sink your teeth into.
Right, right. I think Barack Obama kind of falls in the same category for almost opposite reasons. He's just totally smooth. I call him the Frank Sinatra of American politics. You know, he's not as funny as Trump, but, you know, I don't know. They have the same kind of thing going on, though, on completely different parts of the spectrum.
What I think Obama did was he allowed a lot of people to feel very righteous and intelligent simply by either voting for him or because of the way that he spoke. You know, he sounds like he could be he could have been brought up in the NPR studios.
Yeah, that's right.
He's got that smooth, emotionless voice that I think some Americans assume that if you talk like that, oh, that's what a serious, intelligent person has to talk like. Whereas Trump, with his, you know, New York bombast, the kind of jokey way that he talks, people just, they identify that as, oh, that's somehow unsophisticated, that's unintelligent. But
it's funny you should bring that up. And I assume you don't watch the show, but two or three nights ago, I went on a total screed about the fact I hate National Public Radio. I can't stand it. It's the sound. I don't mind what they're saying, although I'm not, it's a little too liberal for me personally, but just the sound is so fucking precious. I'm going to strangle Robert Spiegel, but you're right.
and it's funny though, because sometimes they do have, like in Chicago, there are some reporters who have the real like thick Chicago accent, and you hear them on NPR and it's like, wow, that's really not something I would think of hearing on the FM dial, AM radio or something. But no, I mean, to that point, you know, there's something about both NPR's absolute failure to remain objective during the Trump era. You know, they were always liberal leaning.
Yeah.
But
right.
They had the capacity to provide like serious journalism.
Right.
Not simply succumb to their opinions. And the thing is, what made them and still makes them somewhat important is they can actually field some reporters internationally.
Yes.
That's the thing. That's what's really such a shame about the bias of a lot of media organizations, that when it comes to some issues that are a bit less political, although oftentimes they do still have the, you know, State Department slant on things. But, you know, when it comes to just providing coverage of what's happening in Asia, Europe, Africa, whatever else, they actually have people who they can field. That when you don't pair that with objectivity, when you don't pair that with the ability to really like talk to Americans in a way that is not condescending, it's such a loss because, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the alternatives, a lot of the media ecosystem built up around conservative politics, they don't yet have that sort of journalism.
That's correct. I describe this as I'm parsing words here, as the difference between bias and propaganda. I mean, you're always right. For going back 150 years, most newspapers in America have had a declared bias. You know, we're either liberal, we're conservative. The Wall Street Journal is conservative. The New York Times has always been liberal. But now it's getting to the point, and yeah, NPR has always been liberal. Okay, fine, that's fine. But like you said, and it's a syntax of how you describe this. So I'm using different words to say the same thing you're saying, and that is, it's gone beyond bias to the point where they're just like, I think they're just spewing propaganda. I mean, it's like, you know, and you're right. It's kind of sad in a way. I don't mind the bias. I can deal with that. But, you know.
Yeah. Well, you look at the repeal of, I believe it's the Smith-Mundt Act, allowing the government to directly provide propaganda to Americans. That's one factor. You look at what I think is the bigger issue, frankly, the professional culture in newsrooms, which all, especially since most newsrooms select people who have a master's in the subject, they come from a particular kind of background.
Yeah.
Economically, in terms of how they view the world, journalism school winnows that down. It creates people who, frankly, often lack practical skills in other areas of life. You don't have a lot of people.
No shit.
Yeah. It's a shame when you have people who, you know, stockbrokers or doctors are successful in some other area and they can write and they go into journalism. They're such incredible contributors a lot of the time.
But hold it. All right. You're in a newsroom and your paper has a reputation to be conservative. Yeah. And if you read a Wikipedia and the description of the Epoch Times, you know, you're all extremist, you know, radicals. And I just, my personal thing about this, I've had a lot of people from the Epoch Times on the show. And that is, it's like, you hate communist China. Like who doesn't? I mean, are you going to call me, am I radical because I hate communists? It's like, what the hell? I don't understand, you know? But I think it's just because you guys, you know, it's not liberal, so therefore it's evil, you know?
And one thing I would add is that, you know, the commentary section, a lot of our writers are conservatives, libertarians, but the newsroom itself, there's a separation between that and the commentary stuff, which is mm-hmm. huge. And one of the issues with a lot of publications that have not been smeared so frequently, so vociferously, so unapologetically by their competition in the news business, a lot of those places have allowed that to break down. You know, you can, for example, find at the Harvard Nieman Journalism Labs a very well-circulated article saying that objectivity in journalism is totally over. The point
yeah.
of journalism is social advocacy.
Right,
social
I've heard advocacy. This. Right, yeah.
It's crazy when you think that these are the people who are the arbiters of truth. And then they're also surprised that they're all getting fired.
But if you're only, hold it, if you're only 33, you've only been out of school less than 10, about 10 years. How did you escape this?
Well, you know, I don't know if I totally did. What I'd say is that the more that you read, the more that you're open to alternative points of view, including, I would say, you know, liberal left points of view, because as a journalist, I don't want to shut myself off from any perspective. The better you are equipped, I think, to not simply end up parroting the comfortable lines. I also just find it kind of, frankly, I'm a bit of a contrarian, so I just find it boring to be thinking or saying the same things as a lot of people.
But were you sitting, where did you go to school? I don't even know.
University of Chicago.
Were you sitting in class 10 years ago thinking, oh my God, he's spewing bullshit? Did that occur to you, or at the time were you buying it?
One of the wonderful things about the University of Chicago is that they have a very strong free speech stance.
Uh-huh.
They've formed it subsequently. I don't know if you've looked into this, but they got their free speech statement that the now deceased president, Zimmer, I believe, was responsible for. But even when I was there, I had an opportunity to take a class, I believe it was called Intro to Marxism. I also took classes taught by more conservative professors. I was able to get actually a pretty wide array of
That's
ideas.
That's great.
And it was all found, I feel like just a commercial propaganda from Chicago, but they really do like emphasize the basic.
No, but I don't, is the president of the school named Zimmer? I don't know that.
He was, he's unfortunately died a few years ago.
Oh, because it was about 3-4 years ago. Somebody there, the president put out a statement and said, you want safe space? Go somewhere else. I mean, that was basically what it said, you know, so we're not going to cater to this. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool, you know.
And they're genuinely committed to that. I mean, I'd say that. You know, in terms of the faculty, you can look into how they donate. They tend to be more liberal because that's just how universities tend to be.
Right.
But they're genuinely committed to free speech. They're not. They're a place where it's, and there are a few institutions like this where you can actually, you know, hopefully learn how to think for yourself.
Yeah. Well, you obviously, if you're going to be a journalist, you want to take a class in Marxism. You want to understand it. You know, the only problem is if you're somewhere where you can't take a class in like Hayek or, you know, that's the problem is that, you know, that, you know, so.
There's propaganda for one side. You don't allow, especially young people who are very, you know, if people feel like they've got to adopt a particular set of values, not just to succeed in the classroom, but as many people predicted 10 years ago, now to succeed in the workplace, now to succeed in the upper echelons of American life, if you have to adopt a particular set of views, then it's very difficult to go against that current.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so do you mind if I ask, how did you get your job at the Epoch Times? Did you just apply, or did somebody say go here, or how did, what happened?
So this was in the midst of the response to COVID,
uh-huh.
and I had been seeing a lot of Epoch coverage of that issue, which struck me as something I wasn't seeing a lot of other places. I was reporting for local places in Chicago, and at that time I was looking for jobs. I saw that there was an application, and so I applied thinking, you know, this seems like a place where, in particular on the COVID issue, I was very upset and disappointed with what I felt was a total failure on the part of American journalism to detach itself both from the corporate interests, you know, Pfizer, whatever else, and also from that immense government pressure.
Yeah.
And it struck me as one of these kind of testing moments where I think a few publications, but in particular Epoch, did a pretty good job of
yes.
not simply parroting the government line or the
but
corporate
unfortunately,
line.
I think you agree with me, as the majority of journalism or media in America failed that test.
Not
all of it.
Not only did they fail that test, they have not faced any subsequent punishment. You could maybe argue that the current round of firings in journalism amounts to some sort of delayed punishment. Really, though, I think that the lesson a lot of journalists took away was we need to think for ourselves even less. We need to be even more deferential to the government on some of these issues. And in particular, if an administration is in charge that journalists tend to agree with more, we're going to be less inclined to scrutinize it. We're going to be less inherently critical of it. So for example, on the whole issue of COVID deaths, suddenly there were no like death counters on newspapers, websites. There were just so many things like that made it
Nathan,
obvious. There was this attempt to engineer public opinion.
That's a headline there. I mean, my goal doing these interviews, I always want to get one piece of information that I never knew before. And that's it, man. Holy, that's terrible. That it's like, If you're thinking they're doubling down, then basically, you know,
that's my belief. Well, on the one hand, I think there's a real truth, a real risk there for Americans. And don't forget that when Trump is in the news, he is just catnip for journalists and for readers and for viewers. He can entire desks at big papers can be filled up with people writing Trump related stuff.
Yeah.
So if he's the nominee, there will be this incentive to amp up the coverage. On the other hand, as I just said, I think there's an increasing number of Americans who are, they've both seen the alternative in the form of Biden, and I think they're just generally becoming dissatisfied with what they're hearing from the media. So if they're not going to be buying what the media is putting out, unless the media is, in many cases, this is true, directly subsidized by the state or by nonprofits run by people with a particular political agenda and will stop at nothing to advance that agenda, then, you know, you're probably going to see some course correction through market forces when it comes to our media. We're starting to see that, but
that's what's happening already, right? I mean, you're talking about what's going on in newsrooms. People are losing their jobs. It's mostly because demand for the product is starting to go down a lot.
And it's a shame because there is, you know, on the less political side, there are functions to local journalism, just shining the light on things. That is inherently important. That is genuinely critical for democracy.
Right.
Not in a like protecting democracy propagandistic sense, but you know, you do want to actually have journalists doing that sort of work. But unfortunately, a lot of them have done a disservice to the profession, both by behaving like an increasingly insulated Washington, New York based guild, and then you know, doubling down, as I said, on their own sense of righteousness.
And speaking of that, you know, I haven't told you this, but you recommended that I book Davis Hunt from the pamphleteer on the show. He's coming on next week. So,
fantastic.
And you know, and he apparently, and I didn't know that until I talked to him, is that his thing is mostly local news. I mean, I've looked at the pamphleteer and it's mostly, not entirely, but it's largely a Nashville centric publication. He wants to talk about local news and I don't know if you caught the top of the show. The sad part is it's the part of news we need the most, and it's the people are the least interested in it. I got to admit, I'm not interested either. I don't know why. I really don't. But, you know, it's like, well, there's stuff we need to know about where we live, and nobody's interested in covering it, and nobody's interested in, right now it seems like nobody's interested in reading it. I don't know if that's because no one's making it interesting. I don't really know, you know?
I think you're right. There's just something about the national news, especially right now. I think national news and international news seems particularly interesting. But Davis is doing yeoman's labor covering Nashville and trying to, in particular, if in Nashville you look at the competition and a lot of it has a fairly clear left-leaning bias, if there's no corrective to that, if there's nobody really trying to provide the alternative, then, at the local level, people trying to understand, okay, what does this issue mean? What should I do? They go on Google and they look up what are the first few results for news, and they're going to get a kind of distorted picture, which is the point, especially for people who don't expect to make profits off of news, but they still have, a nonprofit foundation or they're subsidizing a newsroom somehow. They just want to engineer this response. They're not looking to make an immediate profit from it. So you do need people who can provide some sort of countervailing narrative. That's hugely important, and he's doing important work as well. But of course, I am a massive hypocrite championing local news when all I'm doing is running around the country.
Yeah, but that's your job too, On the other hand, I've been alive or been working for 45 years. I feel very, very strongly that we can't have nonprofit newsrooms. I've worked for a lot of nonprofit organizations, and they are the most politicized of any organizations ever. The one thing about for-profit companies, people may disagree. People, they're off on the power trips, all sorts of shit. But at the end of the day, everybody knows we're here to make money. But you get a board from a nonprofit, people are there for all sorts of different reasons. Some want to change the world. Some of them are crazy. Some of them have a delusion about what's going on. It's just nuts. And no, I'm really against nonprofit journalism. And that seems to be the thing people are talking about right now. It's like, we need to be a nonprofit corporation so we don't go, bust. But maybe you need to go bust. I don't know.
Yeah. Like I said, I think there's some areas like international coverage and a few other, I'm not averse to having nonprofits try to get people out and like cover meetings in some form or another. But especially, if you actually want people to pay for it, that creates a different people pay for things that they're interested in.
Right. Yeah. Okay, I got to go. I'm going way back here. But you mentioned the fact that you were in South Carolina with the vice president, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were in the room with her, right?
This wasn't a room. This was an outdoor pavilion.
You were in her presence. So tell me, being actually live with her, does she come off as stupid in real life as she does on TV?
She didn't say many words when she was there. I think that the point of the South Carolina visit was to engineer a particular narrative, which is that Donald Trump is going to reintroduce Jim Crow or something like that if he is elected. And so she said a few words, not explicitly to that effect. Jim Clyburn, who was also there, said things to that effect. I think she executed what she had to well, but she didn't have to do a lot.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm going to say.
Okay.
She wasn't as gaffe. What she said was nowhere near what, in his recent evening press conference, President Biden attempted to say, kind of stumbled around, as he said. Harris, though, is not a natural politician at all. She has that unnatural laugh. She's someone whose rise is, in some respects, inexplicable. I'm not going to get into it. You can look into her.
No. We talk about it all the time. We know.
You can look into her early history in
California.
Right.
That's right. We know what's going on.
To me, I always return to this fact, which is strange. I think that one of the advantages of the Democrats is that they're increasingly the party of, educated professional types. A lot of people who you'd expect could fill up the bench for presidential candidates, but it doesn't, if you have Harris and like Buttigieg and even Newsom, some Republicans in particular are afraid of him. I think they kind of see him as like a bizarro version of a Republican or something.
Uh-huh.
But when he's up, like, for example, when he was up on stage with DeSantis, I thought that DeSantis would really love it because of his frankly rather poor performances in the previous presidential debates. But Newsom just came across as kind of villainous. And I think he was attempting to make DeSantis look foolish. But at times it didn't seem very endearing. It just seemed kind of, I don't know.
That's my take on him. Exactly,
yes,
what you're saying.
Very warm.
Yeah.
And Bill Clinton, you could say many things about him, but he came across as warm to audiences. He was someone who could charm a room. The same was true of, I could name many recent candidates, even Howard Dean, who didn't amount to much in the end. He, I think, had more political chops than a lot of the more recent people that we're seeing from the Democrats, which, again, it just kind of baffles me that there's not a deeper bench for candidates who would be strong presidential contenders. But again, maybe there are those people, and the party is interested in just advancing a certain sort of candidate who will advance a certain narrow set of narratives. I don't know. I don't want to get into totally speculative territory.
You brought up the Newsom DeSantis comparison, though, is something I was talking about at the top of the show regarding entertainment, and that is people have very specific talents that don't necessarily mesh commonly. So, like, Newsom, to me, is a masterful talker. I just think the guy's just, I mean, he's just, he can talk, he could talk his way out of a barrel full of fish. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's bullshit, but he's a masterful bullshitter. He's fantastic at it. But it's pretty obvious that as a politician, he doesn't execute very well. I mean, I'm just looking at the results in California. Not a lot's going right. And DeSantis is kind of the opposite. He doesn't really have a lot of personal charisma. He's kind of plain spoken. Nothing really comes out. But when it comes to doing the job, he seems to be excellent at it.
That's where I draw a distinction between politics and governance. I would say that Newsom has proven to be a very good politician, both for the reasons you mentioned and because I think he's good at negotiating the different factions within California, which frankly are basically ethnic and along other identitarian lines. He's pretty good at doing that while also being the guy with the very conservative father and mother-in-law from the Getty oil background. In terms of governance, I mean, I think he's advanced things that California Democrats want. I think they would say, wow, he's done a fantastic job. The fact that people are leaving the state, various other indices, capital is leaving the state in many cases, that would seem to present a different narrative. But at the end of the day, if his voters believe he's governing well, what are his incentives to change?
That's really true. Well, one incentive might be that they're going to go bankrupt. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I don't know when it's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if he'll be out on the watch, but yeah, that state's going to go bankrupt. What happens then? I mean, shit. You know, well, I tell you what, we've been talking about this a lot on the show. The federal government might go bankrupt. I mean, there's a lot of people. I have an economist, Murray Sabrin, who comes on regularly. He thinks there's going to be a major economic catastrophe before the end of the year. I know other people who think that too. I also know a good friend of mine. He's in finance, and he's always talking to me. He says, that's bullshit. nothing's, you know, but I mean, we're $34 trillion in debt, and it's getting to the point where the service on the debt is almost 100. Well, I think right now it passed 100% of a gross national product or something like that. It's like, you know, so I mean, how do you get out of a hole like that? You can't.
And I don't see any obvious way, for example, for Republicans in the Trump camp or Democrats to credibly promise that Social Security can be bailed out easily. I had a chance to ask Matt Gaetz about this in Keene, New Hampshire, when he was there campaigning for Trump.
Uh-huh.
And his response was, we're going to spur economic growth, plus we can put a few other usually permanent items on the chopping block to some extent, you know, move some more Medicaid to the states, address some of the non-defense discretionary spending. So, you know, things like the Department of Education. I'm no specialist in economics. I am no specialist in the budget. But from where I'm sitting, that doesn't seem totally plausible. But people really don't like the idea, and understandably so, because there has been an issue with things like the, you know, these trust funds being raided over the years for other projects, programs, and such. But people don't like the idea of these things that they paid into for so many years not being there.
Oh, right.
And the notion that that could happen, my frank opinion is that I think some people in government imagine, okay, if we flood the United States with enough working age adults, not only can we continue to maintain the military, but we can maintain the social safety net. We can do all these other things. And so that's maybe one among multiple rationales for allowing so many people to flood the country illegally.
Nathan, let me ask you about that. I mean, it's pretty obvious to me that the reason they're letting these migrants is because they want to hope to convert them to vote someday. But how much of the sentiment do you think is behind the fact that it's just cheap labor too?
Well, yeah, it's both. I mean, that's been traditionally the real bipartisan area is whether you're the Koch brothers on the right or, you know, Democratic machine in a big city on the left. You want the combination of in one case, cheap labor, on the other hand, votes. I do think that the kind of open borders libertarian wing, there's a reason that it's fallen out of favor. There's a reason a lot of them no longer want to associate with Republicans, because there is this strong populist backlash against that. Especially, I mean, I think for a variety of reasons, one being that people are no longer buying the economic rationalization that bringing in people as cheap laborers is going to benefit their wages. You know, being outcompeted by people who can live like 10 to a studio apartment and who, you know, are also receiving government assistance in various forms when they're not, you know, for a variety of reasons, people are just no longer buying the notion that this is the economic panacea that the brain trust at the Cato Institute wants you to think it is. But yeah, I think it's primarily about votes. But I think there are other factors as well. Frankly, I think without the impetus of people who really don't like the United States as it has been, as it is now, without that impetus, you would not have, and I would say other countries as well, maybe a certain discomfort with the demographic makeup of the United States, intrinsic to the way that some people think, is driving driving some of what we're seeing. And that's an ugly thing to think that that could be the case, but you look at this happening in so many different ways in so many different places, and it's hard not to draw conclusions.
My theory, tell me if you think I'm wrong, my theory is that all these anti-Israel protests that have happened in major cities across the United States and these campuses are one of the reasons they're being so relentless about this. And I don't know if this is by design or it's just an unconscious thing, but I think it still might apply, is they're trying to convince the American public there's way more people that agree with them than there really are. So it's like, we'll go out, we'll block the freeway, and look, there's 500 people here. And then people think, oh my God, it's like, maybe am I on the wrong side of this or something? When in reality, there's still only like 2% of the public. And now that's kind of what I'm thinking of this. Do you think there's anything, any truth to that, or am I wrong?
One of the striking things about those protests as compared to, you know, what we saw with BLM in 2020 is that I do think that the BLM protests were larger in number. But on the other hand, there was, I think there were, when you take in the entire scale at which both have occurred, and in particular the duration of the Palestinian protests, you have like roughly ballpark comparable amounts of dissatisfaction. But the pro-Palestinian faction, anti-Israel faction, they just don't have the same buy-in from Democrats as the BLM people did in 2020, in particular during an election year when they really wanted to highlight the issue and, you know, make it appear that Trump was this horribly divisive racist monster, as compared to this year when highlighting those protests would make, you know, the depiction of Biden would be he's this terrible warmonger or whatever. And so that, I think those are some different, it's a different situation, but there are points of comparison is my takeaway.
So you're going to South Carolina to handle the Republican primary. Let me just ask you straight out. Well, okay. First of all, right now, according to the polls, Haley's going to get wiped totally. And is that the way you see this too? Or?
Yeah, I've spoken to voters. I've spoken to most of the Republicans in Congress and a number of people in the state house, including the leader of their Freedom Caucus. The consensus there from everybody except for Ralph Norman, who is the only Republican in the federal Congress in that delegation who endorses Haley, even he said, I don't know if Haley's going to win. But everybody else is expecting her to lose. You have a lot of people also who, by the way, were not so hot on Trump in 2016, but who they see which way the wind is blowing. You know, you talk to voters, and there are, I think, a legitimately large number of voters, when you take independents and Democrats into account, who, you know, in a, let's say, imagine a hypothetical direct matchup, not in a Republican primary, but a general election matchup between Haley and Trump. Haley might actually stand a stronger chance than Trump under that scenario, because you do have people who, they like the way that you governed, or they don't like Trump, in particular the Democrats and independents often don't like Trump personally. But the Republicans are just so strongly pro-Trump, and frankly, they have been since 2016, if we're being honest. But, you know, they are not in the mood to put even Haley, who a lot of them a few years ago would have liked. You know, she was initially endorsed by, I think it was like the Liberty Caucus, these other, you know, more sort of Tea Party aligned groups. She ran as more of a conservative, and in many ways she governed as a conservative, not to the total satisfaction of all conservatives. But, you know, even with all those factors, South Carolina Republicans just, they clearly, even before the vote comes in, they've made their choice. There's a lot of money still pouring in to Haley. She's got an ad campaign out there. Certainly she's campaigning, and maybe I could be surprised, but I really don't think I'm going to be.
Well, and you alluded to this earlier, and so I'm going to ask you now as we leave here for a prognostication. So there's a lot of shit that can happen. There seems to be the assumption by many people that Trump is going to win in the fall. My thing is that I don't think you can be you can't assume that. It's like I think, like you were talking about the RNC, the Republicans are great at fucking things up, you know, and they seem to have been given kind of by the incompetency of the Biden administration a path to victory here, but I could see them dragging victory out of the jaws defeat or whatever. Well, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen?
They stole the ball from the Biden team, and then they're going to just end up doing an own goal.
That's right. Yeah, right. That's right.
Mixing up my sports metaphors here, but we're talking about the same basic thing.
Yes, we are. Uh-huh.
I think there are a lot of factors, obviously, that Trump is fighting, the various legal cases, although the Willis, Georgia case. Certainly there are some questions now about Fannie Willis.
Oh, man. Hold it. You know, okay, we could talk about that for an hour, but wasn't that just a shit show? Like, holy shit.
Yeah,
it's hilarious.
Was apparently, you know, leading the judge by the nose.
Yeah,
and all that was very, very strange. And you realize that he actually came up working in her office.
Yeah, right.
Kind of weird, isn't it? Like,
yeah. Janine Pirro pointed out on Fox News, he's up for election in 4 months too. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there, but yeah. Pirro said any other judge would have cut her off. It's like, you know, she should have just been sent back to her room, but. That didn't happen, so I don't know. But that's an aside. So as far as the election in the fall, you're thinking?
These legal cases, some of them are stronger than others. There's this attempt now, you know, scheduling the case to begin in March. The attempt to really just push that forward and there's going to be an attempt to highlight issues that tend to be better for Democrats than for Republicans, at least the way that Democrats frame them. Abortion comes to mind. There will be many, many factors. I think the biggest one to keep an eye on is, again, just the RNC's management of money. They have had a historically terrible fundraising in 2023. You could probably make an argument that some of that is tied into the personal attachment of voters to Trump, donating money to him. A lot of that money is going to his legal battles. On the other hand, at the end of the day, the RNC, especially if they are the party, traditionally a big business and a lot of wealthy people, you'd expect them to do less of a half-assed job. So
yeah.
There's a lot of ways that the Republicans could, as you put it, fuck it up. On the other hand, there are just so many terrible indices for Biden. There was one Bloomberg poll recently that shows him significantly behind in all the battleground states. You also don't have an obvious heir apparent. Harris is not a strong candidate. Newsom probably is not going to be shuffled in. It would also be difficult to shuffle him in at the convention. I don't think that Michelle Obama is going to run. That's mainly, like, frankly, like conservatives like to talk about that, but I don't hear that from Democrats.
Right.
From liberals. She doesn't like politics. It does seem like Trump is in a position to win. Obviously, it's a very strange election. Many things could go sideways for him.
Right.
But things do look good for him. And I do think there were headlines not that long ago saying that a lot of Wall Street is behind him. There's more people with influence and money in American life who are on his side this time.
Or at least they're assuming he's going to win, right? It's like both Wall Street and the international scene seem to be going under the assumption he's going to win, but that, you know, like I said, that doesn't mean he will, you know, but.
I think they're reconciling themselves to it more than they were even a year ago. And some of that is also dissatisfaction with Biden, including by factions of what you might call the elite.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. One more question here. You were talking about, we were talking about the difference between bias and propaganda in the media. So it does seem like in the last 2-4 weeks, especially now that this HER thing came out, all that sort of stuff, that the media is finally kind of waking up to that, oh my God, this guy can't talk. and there seems to be some indication that maybe they're thinking, well, I got to get off the boat here or the boat's going to sink with me on it. You know, it's like, I haven't been doing my job in 3 years and now all of a sudden, like, maybe we should, you know, am I onto something here or?
Yeah, you know, at this point, I feel like I'm just speculating on shadows.
I'm asking you to speculate. That's why I am, yeah.
What I guess seems interesting to me, we were initially talking about discussing this, but in the case of this recent New York special election for George Santos's seat,
yeah,
I think one reason for the strong media attention on it is partly because of, you know, the uniqueness of Santos, but this is a way to kind of frame how 2024 is going to run. You have, you know, Nassau County, more conservative than some suburban district, the sort of place where if Trump was going to be competitive in New York or in a similar battleground state, you would want him to do well there. He would want to do well there at least. And he ends up losing it more narrowly than he lost the Queens portion of the district. But it's still a way to kind of frame the way that this is going to proceed in the coming year. There's not going to be nearly as much press, I would imagine, for the special elections to replace Bill Johnson in Ohio and McCarthy in California. Those are pretty safely Republican seats.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that there's you're going to be seeing, when you actually step back from all and look at, okay, what purpose does the narrative serve? Narratives that tend to advance one side over the other. But you're right. There's something going on. I mean, I wonder who in their right mind sent Biden out. Did he was this kind of a King Lear moment from him, where he just went out into the storm?
Yeah, I know. Supposedly it was. What I have heard is that that he said, "Damn it, I'm going out there." You know, that's what he told the staff.
And his wife, they're both willful people. He is, I don't think, interested in stepping down from this position he's been working for his entire life.
That's right.
You could argue that he made a deal with party and with himself to become the sort of political power that he is today. And yeah, I don't think that he could be reasoned. And I mean, think of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who, when there was a point that she should have stepped down, she chose to stay on.
Yeah.
And many of the cheerleaders were just excited to see this. And this is probably her pride is the reason that the Supreme Court is a very different composition today.
Yeah.
So
Nathan, I hope maybe around April in a couple of months you're willing to come back. I want to check back in with you. That's right. We've been talking now for about 50 minutes, and we never got around to the Santos thing. I mean, never got even around to half the shit I had on the list. So it's like I love hearing what you have to say, though. So
well, I'm glad to hear that it was good talking, and I'll look forward to. If Haley is still in the race at that point, I'm not going to eat a hat. But I don't know. Maybe I'll have like a dessert or something that I can eat. Hat-shaped cake.
That's okay. Because we'll eat it together. It'll be cardboard.
Cardboard-shaped cake.
Okay, yeah, right. Or a pizza with cardboard underneath it. I did that years ago. But
it's more of a Lent thing, I guess.
Right. Thanks, Nathan. We'll talk to you soon. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Glad being on as always.
You take care. We'll see ya. That's Nathan Wooster from the Epoch Times. So Nathan covers both politics and energy and environmental issues for the Epoch Times. Of course, we never even got a chance to talk about that. We never did. It's like just a really, really knowledgeable guy. And then, you know, he's actually going around like doing it, you know. It's like most people are sitting at a desk like me, you know. What do I know, you know. So it's pretty cool. Nice to talk to him. So, yeah, I'm hoping we'll have him back in a few weeks. We'll check in during the course of the campaign here. So I got a couple more things for the C block here. Just want to run this by you. First of all, Ross Coulthart is an Australian journalist, and he's highly respected. He's only written a few books on a few subjects, but one of the subjects he wrote a book on was UFOs. I think it's called In Plain Sight, I think it is. And I've read that book, and I've been trying to get him on the show. I don't know if I can. I think he's probably too damn busy. But the general thrust of that book is that, well, you know, you're seeing this shit, so it must be real, and everyone's denying it. And this was before the article came out in the New York Times in 2017. And he took a lot of shit for basically talking about what at the time was an unusual subject. But he's now become kind of an expert at this. And people are, and also he was basically vindicated too. So he is saying that the weather balloon, not the Chinese one that they shot down over the Atlantic, but the one they shot down over Atlanta in February of 23, a year ago, that was a couple weeks after the Chinese balloon. Well, they were saying at that time that I think even they said that it was an amateur student balloon or something like that. That turns out to be, Colbert said his contacts in the military have told him that's complete bullshit, that it was a legitimate UFO and the government shot it down. Now, the reason I got that, and that goes into another story I have here too, about the fact that there's several people in the military now who are saying that the American government or the American military regularly shoots down real alien UFOs to capture the technology. But you're fucking with aliens, man. It's like, Jesus Christ. You know, they could probably kill everyone on the planet in 15 minutes. And this is not good. I don't know if this is good. This even gets back to the thing where they're talking about the from 2 days ago, which now, and I don't know if you've heard this because it was only a few hours after it went on the air here, that this thing about the fact that the Russians sent nukes up into space, that turns out to be bullshit. It was a hoax, a false story. So, and the thing is, I kind of was wondering about it ASAP because, first of all, they're saying, well, we're not going to say what the threat is. Then they're saying, well, the threat is the fact that the Russians put nukes in orbit. And then they're saying the Russians put nukes in orbit to bomb other satellites. They're not going to drop the nukes on the ground. I thought, well, most satellites aren't any bigger than a Volkswagen. You don't need a fucking nuke to blow it up. It's like, you don't need that. And that, so I'm starting to wonder, something's wrong here. And it turns out that entire story was manufactured to basically get people to start paying attention to the fact that we need to give money to Ukraine, supposedly. Now, the really weird thing is, and this goes back to what Nathan was talking about, how not all Republicans are Republicans and not all Democrats are Democrats. This false story was apparently headed by Mike Turner, the head of the Intelligence Committee in the House. He's a Republican. And apparently he concocted the story with the White House. This is what the ABC and Fox News were reporting this literally 4 or 5 hours ago. He concocted this story with the White House to basically, it was basically a diversion story. They wanted to like look over here while we send money to Ukraine over there. That was basically the deal. So, and also there's a kernel of truth in it. And as I've said in the past, there's always a kernel of truth to virtually all these stories. And the current, like, for example, climate change, the kernel of truth is the world is warming up. That's real. That's real. Here, the truth was the Russians could do this in the future. And yeah, they could. Yeah, we could too, probably. But yeah, they could. And so that doesn't mean they have. And I don't know if we have nukes in orbit or not. It wouldn't surprise me if we did. It wouldn't surprise me if we did at all, even though by international treaty, we're not supposed to be doing that shit. But it wouldn't surprise me if we are. So hold on. We got a call here. This is like it's an unlisted number. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this? Yeah, I don't know why we get these calls. They're unlisted numbers and people, and there's nobody there. And I don't know if this is just people calling at random or what the deal is. I don't know. But anyway. So the final thing about Mike Turner doing that, the weird thing is that in his district is Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which has always been considered one of the top places for extraterrestrial research in the military. So, you know, a lot of people say it's Area 51. There's a lot of people who said, no, it's actually Wright-Patterson, that they have underground bases or facilities there where they keep this stuff. So, and that's a historical thing because the Foreign Technology Desk for the Air Force is at Wright-Patterson, and that's they do reverse engineering and investigation of crashed like Soviet airplanes or other, you know, stuff, worldly stuff from our adversaries, that they take that there, and that's publicly known. So that there's always been, since the 40s or 50s, there's been this rumor that no, they take the otherworldly stuff there too. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it or not. But anyway, you got a whole bunch of stuff going on there about the fact that the Coulthard says he says he knows for a fact that we are actually shooting down extraterrestrial spacecraft simply to get the technology out of it. And that means we might be killing aliens. It's like, I think most of these spacecraft we see, like these Tic Tacs and stuff that they're talking about that they film, I think are unmanned. I'm using the word man loosely there. I don't think there's people inside of them. People say, well, you couldn't fly around like that because the G-forces will kill you. Yeah, but you know, if you've mastered anti-gravity, you can compensate for that, especially the next generation. You know, they always, that was the deal. They had gravity compensation inside the ship. So it's like, you know, so it doesn't matter what you're doing outside. It's like everything inside's fine. So, yeah. So anyway, yeah, that's our show and that's our week. So next week, I gotta look. I can't remember. We got Larry Newman on Monday. We got Davis Hunt, who I was talking with Nathan about that. That was Nathan actually recommended this guy from the Pamphleteer in Nashville, Tennessee. He's on Tuesday, and Wednesday we have a dynamic duo, Jennifer Oliver O'Connell and Jeff Meyer. And I know we have a guest book for Thursday, and I can't remember who it is, but. And then the following Monday after that, that would be a week from this coming Monday, we have our monthly week in review panel. So we got that going on. I might take the rest of that week off. I'm still thinking about that. I don't know. We'll see. So anyway, I want to thank you guys for watching, and I want to thank and listening. I want to thank Nathan Wooster for joining us. Fabulous conversation. Fantastic. Seriously, I could have talked to the guy for 2 hours. I suppose you wonder, I know Rogan does this. I know there's people who do what I do, 2-3 hour interviews. I don't know. I just get the impression after about an hour, everybody's minds kind of burn out. So I don't want to push it. So our show is because of that. We occasionally we do a show longer than 90 minutes. This one's going to be virtually exactly 90 minutes by the time we're done here. But we've never gone over an hour 45, I don't think. And I don't know if I want to. I just don't. I mean, I have more questions for him. I'd rather have him come back another day. It's like, you know, I could tell our minds start to get tired. So I don't know. It's like, maybe it's just because I'm old. Maybe I am. I'm an old SOB. Good night, Esperanza. Good night, Uncle Donnie. And good night to you, wherever you are. Have a nice evening. Have a nice weekend. I'll see you on Monday. Take care.